Hey everyone, I'm Thanos Davelis, and welcome back to The Greek Current, a podcast by the Hellenic American Leadership Council and Kathy Merini, where we highlight the top stories of the day every afternoon with analysis from guest experts, policymakers, journalists, and HELC staff. William Antholis joins The Greek Current podcast today to discuss a broad range of topics from his latest interview with Kathy Merini, including the post-populist moment the United States is going through and the lessons it can learn from Greece's experience with populism, the U.S.-China relationship and China's foothold in the Eastern Mediterranean through its investment in the port of Piraeus, the Biden administration's foreign policy architecture, and more. William Antholis serves as director and CEO of the Miller Center, a nonpartisan affiliate of the University of Virginia that specializes in presidential scholarship, public policy, and political history. He served as managing director at the Brookings Institution from 2004 to 2014 and as director of international economic affairs for the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. Bill, it's great to have you back on The Greek Current.
Great to be with you, Thanos.
In a recent interview with Kathy Merini, you talked about how the United States is at the beginning of a post-populist moment. When looking at Greece's experience with populism and the way that it's handling its own post-populist moment, do you see any lessons for the United States?
A whole set of lessons. And Prime Minister Mitsotakis, Kyriakos to so many of us who have gotten to know him before he became prime minister, did three or four things that I think the United States should really emulate. One is populism is essentially about identifying the urges, wants, and needs of the people, many of which may be legitimate, and trying to express them all through the voice of one or two people. That's where populism really becomes problematic for democracy and for democratic institutions. And one of the most important things that Prime Minister Mitsotakis did that I think President Biden is already doing is dialing himself back and dialing up the institutions that actually manage an economy and a society and a democracy. So in Prime Minister Mitsotakis' case, particularly in the COVID crisis, he dialed up the public health institutions, and he worked collaboratively with the opposition parties on designing the first shutdowns in Greece and the first response to the pandemic. That's been a little bit harder to manage as time has gone on in Greece, but that's the case everywhere in the world. So thing one is emphasize institutions, de-emphasize personalities. Thing two is when political leaders speak, to ground them in facts and truth. Now, there's always rhetoric. The distinction between truth and rhetoric goes as far back as 2,500 years ago when Plato is writing dialogues between Socrates and Phaedrus about what's more important, rhetoric or truth. And the truth is, it's really hard to know the truth. We all have different takes on the truth. But we can focus on and contest facts and come to agreement about what facts are facts and what facts are not. And I think it's fair to say in the United States for the last 4 years, the previous president did not really care much about the facts. There was no effort to actually prove facts. They would just make assertions about one thing or another and move on. And I think one of the refreshing things about the Biden administration and one of the refreshing things about Prime Minister Mitsotakis and his communications is a belief that facts are facts and a willingness to have debates about those facts, but also a willingness to concede when the government gets things wrong. And I think we're seeing the Biden administration move in that direction. So that's thing two, an appreciation for facts. Thing three, I think, and this is really important, is a belief that rhetoric does not always have to be turned up to 11. Do you remember the movie Spinal Tap? When they're looking at the loudspeaker for this rock band and Rob Reiner, who's running the documentary, points to the volume control and he says, your volumes go up to 11. And the head of the rock band says, well, that's because when we need a little something more, we go to 11. And he says, well, why don't you just keep the top volume at 10 and just use that? And the guy says, well, but 11 is one more than 10. There was always this emphasis, I think, in Greece prior to Prime Minister Mitsotakis in just taking the rhetoric one level higher than it needed to be. And a lot of that was the emotion of the financial crisis. But frankly, Syriza did that prior to the financial crisis in a number of different settings. And the financial crisis provided the opportunity for Syriza and other populists in Greece to really take it one level higher. And in the United States, a number of our institutions failed in the financial crisis, in the wars in Iraq, the media getting a number of different things wrong that allowed the past president of the United States to rage against the machine. And, you know, to say that the exaggerations of the past were not founded in failures of previous institutions would be wrong. But that doesn't justify the exaggerations. And I think dialing down the rhetoric allows for a sane conversation where people of different legitimate viewpoints can actually have a conversation. And I think we're starting to see that in the United States as well. President Biden inviting in Republican senators to present their plans for a stimulus and to have a sane and respectful conversation about those things is a sign that we are trying to move in a post-populist direction in the United States. It will not be easy. Both parties have their share of loud and populist voices. But I think establishing a conversation among the sane is an important part of a post-populist democracy.
Bill, in the same article on Kathy Medini, you also looked at the U.S.-China relationship. And you've been following China over the years. And you pointed out that China is the greatest issue facing the United States at the moment, even greater than the threat posed by Russia. A recent Foreign Affairs article also noted that tension between the United States and China will only grow and competition will intensify. Can you give us first a broader outlook on the U.S.-China relationship and where these tensions are?
I'll put it in the following way. Amidst all of the populism of the past administration, including populist rhetoric about China, the one thing that there appeared to be a consensus on was that the relations between the United States and China were in a bad place. And the fault for that lay with the Chinese. I think Democrats and Republicans both wanted to put a lot of blame at the doorstep of the Chinese. For good reason, both on the economic and on the security side. The economic promise that started in the late 1990s, early 2000s, where Democratic and Republican administrations reached out to China and wanted to bring them into the global economy in the hopes that that would change the internal politics of China and lead toward liberalization. That led over the course of the next decade to both a lot of economic integration, but a growing trade gap where the United States imported a lot from China and U.S. exports to China came with a set of constraints and did not match the imports. Now, economists might tell you that that was still in the U.S. economic interest, but the benefits were so dispersed and the pain points so great, particularly in manufacturing towns in the United States, that that led to an imbalance that was a problem for both Democrats and Republicans. On top of that, China was trying to bend the rules about not just what the terms of trade between the two countries were, but about the global trading system itself. And then what happened in the mid-2010s, the last decade, was that rather than that leading to political liberalization in China, it actually led to political centralization and rising authoritarianism in China. And on the security side, China taking the gains and the benefits from trade and investing in a bigger and more outwardly focused security and economic investment apparatus. Everything from a stronger military presence in places like the East China Sea to the Belt and Road Initiative, which saw China investing in infrastructure around the world. What I think that led people in the United States, Democrats and Republicans, to agree is that the terms of trade and the terms of security were readjusting in a way that made them feel uncomfortable. Now, how the Biden administration goes around in resetting those terms of trade will, I think, likely be very different than the Trump administration. I think they're going to try and tone down the rhetoric vis-a-vis China, but I think they're going to be, frankly, more focused on the implementation of a few key strategic priorities, trade and security side. They're in the earliest days of defining that, and it does have huge impact on U.S.-Greek relations, particularly, as I noted in the Kathy Medini interview, the port of Piraeus, where China came in at a moment when Greece was weak during the economic crisis, invested in a port that the U.S. or Europe was not prepared to invest in, did not make explicit what the terms of that investment were, but then on a series of other different decisions, China has tried to wield its muscle, and that's making people in the United States and in Europe quite uncomfortable.
You describe China's investment in the Port of Piraeus as the Achilles heel in the U.S.-Greek relationship in that article. How do you think that Greece should be managing the situation vis-a-vis the United States and its partners in Europe?
I think the most important thing at the beginning of a new administration is to hear from the administration what its concerns are and to be open to them. And I expect that they will be, and that the United States, once it organizes itself in Washington, which will take some time, will have a more developed point of view on this issue. I know that the diplomats on the ground in Greece are watching this situation carefully, but the senior leaders in the United States will need to get confirmed. Right now, only Tony Blinken has been confirmed at the State Department. And, you know, General Austin has been confirmed at the Defense Department, but their deputies and the assistant secretaries, undersecretaries will need to be confirmed. The good news on the U.S. side is that they have a terrific team that have been designated for those junior level positions, even though we don't, for instance, know yet who the assistant secretary for Europe is. We know that the undersecretary will be Toria Nuland and the deputy secretary will be Wendy Sherman. These are people that know the region well, that know Greece well, and know the security interests well. And I suspect that they will be both sympathetic to the Greek position on how that arrangement was made, but will also be firm in focusing on long-term U.S. national security interests in the region.
Biden spoke at the State Department yesterday, laying out his goals to reengage U.S. diplomacy in the world. What do you make of Biden's statements, and what can you tell us about the broader Biden foreign policy architecture? For example, how important is it that the United States is returning to a normal national security process?
Well, look, I think it's extremely important. And the way that I think of all these things brings together both my experiences as a practitioner, but also my time spent in research settings, both think tanks and now at universities. Since the end of World War II, the United States has defined its economic and security relations around the world through a prism of both the interests and the values of industrial democracies. And while that has been present in the American mind since our founding as the first modern democracy, in practice, that's only really been an essential feature since World War II, when the nations that we fought with, the largest and most important of which were democracies. And there were these two non-democracies out there, Russia and China, that since World War II we've had to contend with. Biden is going back to that basic arrangement, but he understands that democracies are more fragile today than they've been since any time since the end of World War I, where democracy, for instance, in Germany was quite fragile and obviously ended up folding and collapsing in the 1930s with the Great Depression that swept across the world. Biden understands the fragility of democracy in the world, and he wants to make democracy central, not just to U.S. foreign policy, but to everything he do. He started out, I mean, you referenced the State Department talk, which I think is important and we can come back to. But let's go back to his inaugural address, where he started and ended with democracy. We've looked at other inaugural addresses, and there are really very few that have done that. The one to compare it with is President Bush 43's second inaugural address, where after the Gulf War, he put the promotion and enhancement of democracy around the world as central to that inaugural address, as a defense of the war that had just been fought in Iraq, even though that war was not about democracy, it was about removing Saddam Hussein. Democracy is on the defensive right now, and Biden wants to stop the bleeding. So I think if you then look at what he talked about when he visited the State Department yesterday, and he has not just a willing partner, but a close friend in Tony Blinken in this, they want to shore up democracy. They want to shore it up where it's weak, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe. I don't think they think of Greece's democracy as weak, but I do think they see it as coming up against some non-democratic or increasingly authoritarian players like in Turkey, but also in the broader Middle East, in North Africa. And they're going to want to make sure that places like Greece, countries like Germany, like the Czech Republic, who have rising authoritarian powers just to their east, within the NATO alliance, Poland and Hungary and Turkey, beyond the NATO alliance, Ukraine, and of course, Russia. These are countries that they're going to want to contend with, and they're going to want to make sure that as they focus on security and economic challenges, democracy is part of the mix. That may sound trite, but the last administration, the president spoke with one voice about this. Secretary Pompeo actually spoke with a democratic voice, but he didn't necessarily manage with the democratic voice because either he didn't believe it or he was looking over his shoulder at a president that didn't seem to care.
Bill, we saw some strong statements this week from the State Department spokesperson on Erdogan's crackdown on student protests and on conspiracy theories that were peddled by Turkey's interior minister that the United States was behind the 2016 coup. There was also a call earlier this week between Jake Sullivan and President Erdogan's foreign policy advisor, Ibrahim Kalin, with the White House readout indicating that the U.S. was conveying its concerns over issues like the S-400s and human rights. Taking all these statements together, are they indicative of a shift in how the U.S. will handle issues with Turkey moving forward?
Yes, I think they are very indicative of a shift. And I think there are two or three things to focus on there. One is the U.S. is going to be not just strategic, but pretty detailed oriented about what its interests are in the region. Again, I think the State Department did its best both as a broad bottom-up institution, but even to some degree top-down from Secretary Pompeo, who made several visits to the region, including to Greece, in trying to lay out these issues. But the administration as a whole was inconsistent in its messaging. And what I think you're going to see by reestablishing a normal national security process in the United States is an emphasis on consistency from the White House, the State Department, the Defense Department on this set of issues. And I think that we have been extremely well served by our diplomats on the ground in Greece, by career diplomats at the State Department, and periodically by Secretary Pompeo on the region. But when the President of the United States himself conveys a different set of messages or has his own conversations that the rest of the government's not privy to, then you see that in the response that that gets from these other actors. They feel liberated to do what they want because the most important megaphone, the one attached to the President of the United States, is not going to call them out on these things. So what may have been most important in the statements from Jake Sullivan, the president's statements at the State Department yesterday, the ongoing statements by the State Department spokesperson, Ned Price, is a consistency in laying out what the U.S. priorities are. And what are those priorities? Those priorities are a Europe whole and free, Turkey, if they're going to be a member of NATO, living up to NATO agreements, including the fact that all members of NATO are supposed to be constitutional democracies, purchasing weapon systems from other NATO allies and not from NATO's principal adversary, Russia. You know, Turkey really is living on a precipice of whether it actually is a NATO ally or not. And the Biden administration is trying to lay out a fence that Turkey is going to need to either climb over if it wants to jump or crawl back over if it wants to stay part of NATO.
Bill, thanks for joining us on The Greek Current. Always great speaking with you.
It's always great to be with you too, Thanos. Thank you.
In other news, Canada's Eldorado Gold Corporation on Friday signed a revised contract with Greece covering its mining operations in the north of the country, where it has faced repeated stalling over licensing delays and environmental concerns. Eldorado has been in talks with the Greek government on a revised investment plan that would secure higher royalties from mining development and new jobs. Greece's energy minister, Kostas Krekas, said the investment plan had been revised to $3.1 billion from $1.4 billion. All the three mines will remain open and will be upgraded, while a total of 3,070 workers will be employed, up from 1,650 today. The energy minister added that under the revised contract, Eldorado will submit a new proposal for building a gold processing plant in 12 to 24 months, while there will be a 10% rise in royalties for Greece. In the meantime, Turkey's president on Friday rebuffed U.S. and European criticism of his government's handling of weeks-long demonstrations at a top Istanbul university, saying they should focus on protests in their own countries instead. Erdogan also vowed to show no mercy to protesters who use violence and reiterated his determination not to allow the demonstrations to spiral into mass anti-government protests like those that took place in 2013. Erdogan also blamed the wife of jailed philanthropist Osman Kavala for provoking student protests, calling her a provocateur and her husband a representative of George Soros in Turkey. Meanwhile, a Turkish court on Friday once again rejected a request for Osman Kavala's release from jail, despite a European Court of Human Rights ruling that called for his freedom. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.